Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Welcome to Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today, our travels on Route 51 take us to the Highway 54 exit south of Plover as we drive south into the farmlands of central Wisconsin and the Buena Vista Marsh. The childhood home and current residence of Justin Isherwood, sixth-generation historian, author, philosopher, and an amateur historian, I meant to say. He's a sixth-generation farmer. His essays have been published in both Audubon and the Wall Street Journal, and his books of fiction include the award-winning The Farm West of Mars, In a Pickle, and Christmas Stones and the Story Chair, and whose books of nonfiction include the autobiographical Farm Kid, Tales of Growing Up in Rural America, and The Book of Plow, Essays on the Virtue of Farm, Family, and Rural Life. Today on Route 51, a conversation with Justin Isherwood as we talk to him about his attachment to the flat central Wisconsin prairies and marshes of his childhood and the broader themes it has inspired in his writing. And as always, we invite you to join the conversation at 261-6371, 261-6371, or toll free at 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Justin, I hope you didn't mind me calling you an amateur historian and philosopher.
But I think I'm an amateur human being, Glenn, but that's just my own opinion on myself.
And you are calling us today from the family farm near Plover. How is planting going this spring?
Oh, well, it's been a wet and what seems to be a classically average Wisconsin spring. It's kind of chilly, as everyone who's listening knows. Don't put the blankets too far away yet, but it's been okay. Thank you for asking.
Well, what chores are you doing today?
Well, the reason I'm not you invited me to come up to the studio, and today I happen to have a contract for sweet corn that is due into the ground by the end of the day, and after you and I get done on the phone, we will or on the radio, I will go back and finish my contract.
How do you balance writing and farming? When do you find the time to write? Farming is, it's a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day job.
Well, long ago, I had myself cloned. And while I'm speaking to you now, there's a guy up in the back room writing busily away. How do I find the time? I do have winters. Thomas Jefferson who said that all farmers should find the time to write of their life, if only so to make them better farmers. And I think there's some truth to that in my own life.
And you're right. Thomas Jefferson famously was a farmer who found
yes.
a lot of virtue in the
yes.
rural landscape.
Yes. And, we all like to think that this kind of quiet, humble Virginian, that some part of the farm landscape entered into the words that we all now live by. But I'm as a vegetable farmer, I raise corn and green beans and potatoes, soybeans. Winters, I don't raise those crops anymore. Mother Nature puts an end to my season, and that's when I really turn to writing as I don't know what it is. Is it a second career? It's a second kind of life.
Now, your biography calls you a sixth-generation farmer. It's hard for a lot of people to think of sixth-generation anything. In fact, most of us these days go through about 12 career changes in one lifetime.
So you're wondering how that came to be. Maybe stupidity.
Well, is it accurate? Do you go back six generations?
Oh, indeed. Indeed. My grandchildren are the seventh.
Has that all been in central Wisconsin?
That's on this farm. My great-great-grandfather, and I don't know if I have an attached enough greats, homesteaded in 1855, just below Plover. On the other side of the family, the great-great-great-something-or-other grandfather homesteaded the year of the Black Hawk War, 1832. We've just kind of... apparently we found a good spot. Maybe the kids all ended being a little dumber than smarter, but they didn't run away very far. It is even surprising to me why I ended up here, why my family stuck it out. I don't know if I can give you a good answer other than there are some subtle qualities of the farm life that simply are not available in any other kind of life, any other career. There's that closeness to nature that's on a daily basis. You know, dirt's your
Well, let me. Give me the opportunity here to just read a paragraph from one of your books, the book Farm Kid, and it'll give people an idea of your writing style and your background. This is Justin Isherwood. His words: "I am a farm kid. I had chicken pox when I was 7. Maybe it was 8. Had mumps and pink eye and assorted stuff. I had a dog, a treehouse. I raised chickens for 4-H and ate them. I watched stuff die. It was mean and awful and very cruel. We ate them for supper, so it wasn't so bad. Uncle Fred was eaten, too, by a silo filler, as chewed him up and swallowed the lot. I remember they closed the lid of his box. It wasn't so bad. I had a crow for a pet, a raccoon, badger, skunk, ducks, cats, chickens, cows, pigeons. There were friends, if not my brothers or sisters. And I ate them. It wasn't so bad. That's life on the farm as a farm kid, eh?"
I think so. You know, there's a certain nastiness implied. After all, you end up eating your friends, or at least some of them. And you know, there's a hardness in the farm life as a result. There's not only is the work dirty, long. For a good while in my career, and perhaps every farmer's career, it seems to have been unappreciated by the national economy. But underneath that is a chance to live a life that's really quite unique. I hope it's not a dying life form, but it may well be.
Justin Isherwood. Justin, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back with some more of your observations on living and farming and writing near Plover, near the Buena Vista Marsh. And again, if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions for Justin or questions about the state of farming today and the importance that rural life has in America, give us a call at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. 780-9742. I'm Glenn Mulberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
For more information on regional programming for North Central Wisconsin here at Wisconsin Public Radio, or to have your community event listed with us, check out our local website at wpr.org/WLBL.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit a WPR sponsor, please let them know that you appreciate their support of this station. Thanks very much.
I'm Glenn Mulberg. This is Route 51, Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Those phone numbers again, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Justin, I ran into you last a little over a month ago at the Prairie Chicken Festival south of Milledore. I'm going to play a short piece that we put together after that event. And then we'll come back and talk about the Buena Vista Marsh.
Tom Meyer, project supervisor at the Mead Wildlife Area, teaches a group of grade school kids how to stomp and boom like prairie chickens.
On the count of three, here we go. Oh, you guys are excellent.
The youngsters are learning from the experts, like Bob Welch, a science teacher at Wapaka Middle School.
And then, of course, then they go whoop, whoop. Whoop.
Welch has been involved with the Prairie Chicken Festival for the past 3 years at the Mead and the nearby Buena Vista Marsh in Portage County. teaching kids how to hold and band songbirds and release them into the wild.
You got it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we're going to turn your bird over like that, open up your hand, and then we're going to turn this direction.
To Welch, the festival is not just fun and games. It's a chance to unplug children and their parents from a high-tech virtual world that he thinks is keeping them from what's important.
If kids need all these things, iPods, cell phones, who's going to pay for them? The parent. And if they just make a living and spend that time with their kids, the kids wouldn't need any of these things because they have their parents instead.
Author Justin Isherwood lives on the Buena Vista Marsh, where he says families can still experience a land that is basic and primal.
It still belongs largely to nature. There are places in the Buena Vista Marsh where it's as if the glacier just retreated a few minutes before.
A place where the wild prairie chickens still call out to children and their parents. In Millidore, I'm Glenn Mobert for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
And Justin, as a kid who grew up in Chicago, I was telling you that day that the thing that impressed me was coming up to northern Wisconsin and seeing the beauty of the rivers and the trout streams and the forests and the majesty of the eagles. And you said that what you found impressive was the very plainness of the landscape in central Wisconsin and the marshland. Could you expand on that?
Oh, yeah, you know, when I was asked to do this thing over at Marshfield, I was struck. You know, always we put nature in beatific terms. We are attracted to the great scenes of nature, and indeed the great, as you put it, we're all attracted to the great birds, the eagles, the hawks, the falcons, and it struck me that what's inimical, what's functional, most functional about nature is the plain stuff, the stuff we drive right on by. In doing a little research for that day, I came across the note that the central region of Wisconsin was the last treaty land in the state. The state became, as everyone should know, a state in 1848. But that the last parcel of Indian lands to be negotiated to the U.S. were also in 1948, and they were in central Wisconsin.
Well, why do you think that was?
Well, it was that the area was that plain. Its resources were not particularly attractive. The marsh at that time, it wasn't really a grassland yet. It was one vast bog, perhaps 100 miles on a side, maybe 150 miles on a side. It was not the kind of country that you could go to, take off a few trees, open up a field, and make a livelihood as a farmer. It was land that really people went around. If you look at the early maps of our region and how people got to Wausau, how people came to develop Stevens Point, they didn't go straight through the center of the state. That part of the state was widely avoided. They'd follow the river, they'd go to the east to Berlin and Oshkosh and Fremont, coming in on the Wolf River. That central basin of Wisconsin was so unkempt. It was the wild child and stayed so, and indeed parts of it still are. If you pick up a map of Wisconsin and you look for the density of current civilization, of development of villages and towns, there's a lovely big empty spot in the middle of Wisconsin.
So maybe because the Buena Vista Marsh and the surrounding area was so plain and had such limited economic potential, maybe that's why it's still
indeed
a pristine natural area today.
Yeah, in a way, that's what has followed for a lot of resources. If they don't attract the kind of attention that provides immediate economic reward, they're going to be left for a later day, and that's when we discover the beauty of the American Southwest, the desert countries, simply because it wasn't a place that invited a livelihood.
What is the marsh like at night? Many of us travel through there during the day, but as a person who's grown up on a farm, you've experienced that marshland at all times of the day.
You recall with that question a kind of a neat image. If it weren't for the lights of Stevens Point to the north, of Wisconsin Rapids to the west, Waupaca, the Buena Vista Marsh would probably be the closest thing we have to a black hole, at least in the state of Wisconsin. Maybe that's not quite true, but it's close. One of the things I like most about living where I do, I'm an amateur astronomer, as I am just about everything in, that I can think of, from mechanic to winemaker. I have a big old 8-inch reflecting telescope that I can take out, and because the marsh is the proximity it is, there is a, it's like stepping off the edge of the planet. The sky is just that kind of volume over me, and I don't think of it so much as being on top of me as being besides me. There is a darkness there. You know, it's nothing like the open sea. I have never been to the middle Atlantic Ocean or the middle Pacific, where they say that the primary stars that we take for granted, like Cirrus and Betelgeuse, disappear in the multitude of stars. And unless you get your bearings early with your pointer stars, you will lose yourself simply because there are so many.
And yet, that was really the experience all of humanity, all people had in the 1800s, maybe the early part of the 1900s, before we plugged everything in and turned the lights on.
Yeah. There's a part of me that, believe it or not, there is a dark Earth, the Dark Knight Society, that's what it's called, and it's worldwide. Actually, I think its center is in Italy. And I've been a member of that organization for a long time. Essentially, it's the view that we don't need all the night lights that we have. The security lights perhaps aren't making us any more secure. That we, with proximity lights and things like that, that we could really return our living situations, our villages and our cities to a darker appreciation of the sky.
Justin, in your first novel, and correct me if it wasn't your first novel, The Farm West of Mars, or was that the first one published? You describe a place called Liberty Corners. Is that a real place?
Real place, yes. Matter of fact,
On the map?
No, I don't think it's not on the map. Maybe once upon a time it was. It was, like so many, it was one of those crossroads communities, had a grocery store, a church, a very nice, large two-room school with a basement, which was unusual for one-room schools. What else was there? A post office. And that was about it. But it was because it had the church, and not just down the road. There still is a church there, but there's also down the road the Liberty Corners Buena Vista Cemetery.
Okay.
And that still exists. But, you know, it's one kind of place, like so many. And again, in your neighborhood, if you drive outside of Wausau, you can see the remnants of them, and people who are familiar with the area still know them as those crossroads communities. Again, maybe it was a community club or a tavern. Or
what was it like growing up there?
Hard to be terribly specific, other than there was a great distance in those days, and I'm talking in the mid-50s from what? Maybe it's the shopping mentality. There wasn't such a need to be urban. Rural communities had far more of their own time and space. There was a pace in life that was hinged to our lifestyles. You know, I don't remember television being terribly important. It was the radio was important.
Still is, as a matter of fact.
Yes, it is. It was AM. It was AM radio only before FM came on the scene. It was WLBL. It was the weather report, and my father was such a loyal fan that the radio in the barn was glued to the one and only state station, so that our cows had to listen to classical music, as did his four sons, who probably had a little more desire to listen to Mitchell Trio or Kingston.
You didn't
Trio.
Want to disturb the cows with,
indeed.
With that kind of stuff.
No, he believed that you bring milk on, and there's a specific term to let it come down, let the milk down. That Brahms could do that in Beethoven,
but no rock and roll.
But the Beatles couldn't do it.
Let me read a line from your novel. In fact, it's the first line from the Farm West of Mars. I was born to a farm, thought in the innocence of my youth to be both distant and separate from the rest of the planet. Mars was closer to the township than Philadelphia. Mars seemed red and pretentious in the bell jar of a farm country night. And that describes your description of the night sky in the Buena Vista marshlands.
Yeah, it's in happily good share of it's still there, except for the glows on the horizon of our urban areas.
Here's another line that you wrote. The decline and abandonment of the family farm is a direct result of stripping soil of any identity and ethical or strategic value. What did you mean by that?
You always put hard questions to me.
That's my job.
Yeah, it is. Darn it all. I probably meant that our lives are while we gain the wealth of our lives from land, that land is still not ours. There's a part of it that is essentially its own citizen. I've long felt that there's a part of our view of life which tends to take our human needs as the greatest needs on the planet. And I'm not saying they're not great, but they're not the only ones. And for me, the field is a citizen, as is the tree, as is the trout stream, that they too have a right, perhaps, to live and express. You know, we don't think of them as persons, but they to express what they are, to express that character, is part of, for me, it's part of our being a free society. That there's work in Thomas Jefferson's Democracy to be done yet.
Author Justin Isherwood and a sixth-generation farmer living near Plover and the Buena Vista grasslands. You're listening to Route 51, regional talk radio on the Ideas Network. I'm Glenn Moberg, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. We will be back with more after this.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Bemis Company, a global manufacturer of flexible packaging and pressure-sensitive materials, proud to support its employees and the communities in which they live. Information is available on the web at bemis.com.
Well, life on the farm is kind of laid back. Ain't much an old country boy like me can't hack. It's early to rise, early in a sack. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, a simple kind of life never did me no harm. Raising me a family and working on the farm. Days are all filled with an easy country charm. Thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the griddle. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy.
Our guest today on Route 51, Justin Isherwood, sixth-generation farmer, author, philosopher, amateur historian. His essays have been published in both Audubon and the Wall Street Journal. And his books of fiction include the award-winning The Farm West of Mars, In a Pickle, and Christmas Stones and the Story Chair. And his books of nonfiction include the autobiographical Farm Kid, Tales of Growing Up in Rural America, and The Book of Plow, Essays on the Virtue of Farm, Family, and rural life. Justin is joining us from his farm outside of Plover, where he's been doing chores all day. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That number again is 1-800-780-9742. Justin, let me read another line from one of your books. This one, The Book of Plow. And you find a religious connotation to rural America. that a lot of people find interesting. This is what you write. Most people don't know that God built the first truck. He did. A pickup was idling under a box elder when Adam stepped out of the mud, wondering after his belly button. The first pickup truck didn't have one either. Did God build the first pickup truck?
Well, if you have read my version of the Bible, it did. That hasn't seen print yet, but perhaps it will.
Did your family allow a Bible that wasn't the King James Version?
Well, yes. I think there was, around the family circle, late at night, at Pitch and Horseshoes, when my Uncle Henry would come over, and my Uncle Curtis, and we were raised Methodist, and Methodists, unfortunately, don't know the proper use of wine or beer, any of those things. So these people were, to get themselves away from their farm, started to tell stories. And, you know, knowing that most of them, their basic literary attachments were maybe a bit of Shakespeare, the McGuffey's Reader, and the Bible. And somehow, of those three things, they made up their own version of just about everything else, including the Bible. So when my grandfather would start to recite from Genesis, it ended up being his version of Genesis and not the one that's written down in the book. And that kind of set the pattern for me.
Go on, I'm sorry.
Well, just if grown-ups can do that and get away with it, why shouldn't I be able to do it?
The storytelling tradition is something that you refer to in the Christmas stones. Tell us about the Christmas chair. What was the significance of that chair?
Well, it truly exists. And I will only say this for you, Glenn. It truly exists because I built it. In the story, I suggest that the story chair has been around in my family for generations and generations and generations. That, alas, is not true. However, when I wrote the stories, not so much because the events actually took place as I defined them, but they did take place in the same manner in which I defined them. As I was saying to you, a grandfather who would go off on his own bent on Genesis, I think it was the nature of people. It isn't just my people, but of all people, to weave into the stories of, in the case of Christmas, something of their own origins, their own Advent tale. And Christmas stories the premise is that everybody in the family, sooner or later, has to take in our case, pick up a stone, and you tell a story about that stone. And hopefully it's a Christmas story. And as you may know, Glenn, the stories presented in Story Chair are rather varied. Some of them are sentimental. Some of them are plain cruel.
What's one of your favorite stories?
Which of them is my favorite?
What's one of them? Just if you could share that with our listeners.
You know, you always get. Do writers remember? There is one about the Irish, and I'm just trying to. I'm paging through my. Oh, it's called Tammas O'Toole's Tady Tree. Tammas O'Toole is an invented name. I have very little true Irish in my family. We had higher standards than that, apparently, or lower standards. But anyway, that's probably one of my favorites, simply because it was such a hoot to write. And I pick up on the Irish thing of the independence of them, their identities, which is are known worldwide for their mirth and their good cheer and their fierce defense of things they love. Anyway, I increased the amount of Irish in my blood by writing that story.
You write that when you were in high school, the lowest form of life was the dirt ball. Kids of the present age call each other names, jerk, pencil neck, dweeb, and nerd. as once it was dirtball, hayseed, hick, and most loathsome of all, farmer. Do you still find that urban Americans have that kind of a negative attitude toward rural Americans? Maybe it's just a function of where we grow up and who we are.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's any significant blame to be attached, because after all, we inherently differentiate of who we are versus who someone else is. And, you know, the farm identity, it's an easy one to recognize. After all, farmers are different. They live in a different place. There are some different style points. Underneath, of course, we're all the same, and we can be made into each other probably readily enough. But, you know, so I'm not, for me, there's not any particular blame. And I think as when I was growing up, yes, there were sociological differentiations. There were, quote-unquote, great prospects who wouldn't date a farm kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they had good reason to.
Maybe they didn't want that kind of a life.
Yeah, indeed. Good point. Because
Justin, are you a dirtball?
I am a dirtball. It's taken me a while to realize that I am a dirtball. And I think a dirtball exists philosophically, maybe even theologically, a whole bunch of different realms. It's a personality that I like weather that's rotten. My most enjoyable times driving on the highway are not when the sun's shining, but when it's starting to rain hard or snow hard, because then there's something to do. I hate work that's too easy. I mean, I get sleepy. I'm inherently, my type. I'm of a type of human being on the planet yet. Maybe we're getting on the rare side, but physical labor matters to me.
Well, let's talk about physical labor. And again, if you'll bear with me, I'm going to read a paragraph again from one of your books about hay baling. In the Hellenic age of hay, as so happened to coincide with my childhood, baling hay is what we did every waking moment from the day school let out until it reassembled. The bulk of my childhood, I realize now, was devoted to the consummate comfort of a milk cow's internal organs. Either I was in the business of actively shoveling something into the beast, or else shoveling something out.
Glenn, I can't tell a lie. That's the way it was.
And how did you feel baling hay all during your childhood?
You know, I think there are a lot of things as children that we find loathsome. I did too. If I'm honest with myself, I do not remember thinking I wanted to be a farmer. I wanted to escape like probably 90% of my brethren. It wasn't until I lived in Minneapolis and went to grad school, and I lived in Wausau for 2 years, great city, up above Duck Island. The house I lived in is still there. Cheapest place I could find to rent on a particular weekend. I don't wish to take anything away from the urban life, but there's a part of me that woke up and realized that I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be that close to my neighbor. I didn't want, you know, again, that regimented, a 9-to-5, to get home at night and be clean. For some reason, I didn't know this about myself, and I had to discover it, that there is another way of living. And at that point, I found that it was genuinely and truly ingrained into my psyche that I couldn't escape it. Even though I thought I would, you know, end up get my master's degree or something in English lit and go teach at a junior college somewhere. I actively thought of the ministry, but it didn't take me long to realize that I was still hobbled. I was still attached. With a very pulsing vein to the agricultural life.
But as a kid, and you were saying there were always chores to do, but You had some fun with your friends.
Oh, yeah.
You write a section in the book Farm Kid about the How's It So Society, which you say began with a Pledge of Allegiance, a variable oath. One week our faith was in bicycles, the next to BB guns, another to the Milwaukee Braves, Snapping Turtles, and an older brother's Sun and Health magazine. What was sacred and important to us varied with the season.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that Sun and Health magazine. And if you're the listeners who do not recall that title, it was a early form of, I think it's a nudist magazine. There wasn't a lot of that available in frontier times. Maybe the ladies' lingerie section of the Montgomery Ward catalog or something came kind of close. But anyway, that was one of the sincere points of our childhood, or our boys' childhood anyway. There is an openness to being raised on the farm that probably the urban kid didn't even know, wasn't even aware that there was. I mean, our relationship to vehicles. I was driving a car down the road with my mom's pillow, not on her lap, but on a pillow, when I was 5-6 years old, and nobody thought anything of it. One of my friends drove his family to church when he was 8. And again, I'm being perfectly frank of what it was like. It was not unusual for a kid to be having tractor chores by the time they were 9-10 years old. It was I was responsible for mowing the farm's hay by the time I was 9 or 10 years old, and I relished in it. I felt like I could do a man's job. Not old enough to smoke cigarettes or whatever, you know, some signal odiousness like that, but nevertheless, I think every farm kid realizes there was those kinds of things. In the evening, once the chores were done, you know, we could turn our backs on civilization and run off to the woods. And
as a kid growing up in that environment, too, you developed a sense of self-sufficiency at an early age, didn't you? You talk about the importance of the tomahawk and the match.
Oh, yeah. You know, and self-sufficiency only to a degree. I mean, there were times when we would take a package of hot dogs, some potatoes from the cellar, maybe a couple cans of baked beans and head out for Saturday night. Oh, we took eggs, of course. That in a frying pan and lit out for the woods with a blanket and a match and, as you say, a tomahawk or a hatchet. For in our minds, it was always a tomahawk. We didn't really plan to go camping. We just did. If that's being resourceful, I don't know. I suppose it is. But it was also the liberty, the ease of which you could just slam bang go do it, and get on your bicycle and within 5 minutes be in the midst of a forested section where you didn't know that there even were any white men in Wisconsin. It felt that remote. At least into our minds it did. And that was in the age before jet planes and satellites and as we were talking earlier, the dark sky was darker.
Author Justin Isherwood, we're talking about his books. We're talking about his life as a sixth-generation farmer. And, yes, he is still farming near the Buena Vista Marsh, near Plover. And if you'd like to join us, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. We'll be back after this. We're talking to Justin Isherwood. We're talking about life on the farm. And Justin, you wrote in your book of essays, The Book of Plow, that maybe we ought to be putting plows over the mantelpiece instead of old flintlocks and old armaments. What did you mean by that?
Oh, just that the plow is the symbol of the farmer's life. It's what we live by. We don't live by the gun anymore. We don't hunt for our livelihood. We plow for it. And really, you may not know the technicalities, but it isn't so much the old-fashioned mowboard plow that we use anymore. In fact, on my farm, we're trying to not use the moldboard plow at all anymore, but instead it's called a chisel plow. It doesn't flip the soil over, it kind of stirs it like a mix master, the idea being that you retain organic material longer. But nevertheless, the symbol remains the same, that the tool of our livelihood is that plowshare.
You write, the Garden of Eden symbolically represents the ancestral hunt. The laments are the innocence of the wandering hunter. His unknown nakedness is the vulnerability of the hunter. Sin was to stay in one place and eat the fruit of the furrow to know the hearth of woman. The bias for the old purity of the hunt persists in the biblical account of Cain and Abel. Cain was the farmer and Abel the herder and hunter. Yahweh, apparently, was not into vegetables.
Yeah, I guess I said that. You know, it is a curiosity, and again, I perhaps bringing my theological student background into it. And
were you a theological student?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, college, you write like one at times.
I went off to seminary, and it didn't take me long to realize I really couldn't do that. You know, nobody needs to know my religion, and if in a perfect world, a perfect America, I believe there should be 325 million religions. Each of us would have our own, and we'd be obligated to ourselves to figure it out for ourselves. But anyway, that's...
But in a real sense, aren't we obligated to figure it out for
ourselves? I think so. But, you know, on a more practical basis, a lot of us approach it like it's a franchise meal, that you just step up to the counter and you pay your dues and you get it. And again, I don't happen to see it that way. I don't think, unless you try to chisel out the stone yourself and form something of what life is out of the mud, you don't really get it at all. But again, I part of me doesn't like to go terribly deep into these things because they are so personal. You can't hardly say a thing about religion and not be offensive to some other person's belief.
And that's
the
shame,
last thing in the world I want to do.
That's a shame that when we're talking about something that's so fundamental, it's so hard to talk about because you might end up offending somebody.
Yeah. And I agree. It's a real conundrum because how do we as intellectual and responsible people approach these things unless we can talk about them broadly without people taking insult? But really, it's one of the singular, for me, one of the singular problems of our society and our world society is that we can't have strong discussions about the nature of human spirit and the nature of creation without somebody somewhere from the back of the room or the front of the room taking offense.
And you do find a spiritual connection with rural life and with farming. As it's been passed down from generation to generation. And I'm going to read, I think, one of my favorite paragraphs of yours. A wizened power is in the seed, a force we, for all our literature and science, treat the same, worship the same as less literate societies. It is raining. It is going to storm. It is dark. It has no antecedent. It is it. Of what farmers know, it is the seed. You're really describing something that goes beyond human language.
Well, you know, as you were reading that, I realized how much, you know, I struggle. And again, that's the nature of being a writer in the first place, of how one does struggle to capture a concept. What is the symbolic, seminal point of what life means? And in that particular essay, for me, it boiled down to the seed. And of course, it was an easy one because of not only as I plant potatoes, I plant corn, and here's this inert bit that I combine with the soil and the warmth and photons from the sun, and within a day or two, or sometimes in the case of snap beans, it's within an hour or two. It snaps.
It comes
open.
Up, right.
Yeah. And again, I still find, Glenn, I still find that kind of thing perfectly magical. There isn't anything more awesome through a telescope or through a nuclear power plant than that seed opening up the coddle into the sunshine.
And it's all around us all the time, if we'd take the time to open our eyes and see it. You also say that farmers don't visit psychiatrists because they have a substitute. When farmers pass on the road, they wave. How a neighbor waves reveals his or her frame of mind and the condition of the subsoil as well. And that's true, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You got to come for a ride with me sometime in a pickup truck. And when I'll line my neighbors up. I'll tell them you're coming and just have them drive by, try to get nonchalant.
I'll tell you something, Justin. I live in a rural area in Merrill, and we wave to each other on my little gravel road in the back of our house.
Now, do some neighbors have a particular wave?
Yeah. And you can really tell a person's frame of mind by the way they're waving on that particular day.
Oh, yeah. And if they're going to meet your eyes, if that wave is full and flowing, or if it's kind of, you know, hunkered down and, you know, they're in a hurry, they just, you know, lost the dividend check or whatever, you know. Yeah. That's part of being a neighborhood, when people can tell by subtle signs the health of our minds and the well-being of our spirits.
Justin, unfortunately, it's time for us to wave goodbye to you. But
well, Glenn, first of all, let me tell you, I appreciate your letting me do this from home, because after I hang up, I will go back to the field, and you're a real gentleman for letting me do that.
And you're a gentleman for spending the hour with us. It's been a great conversation.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Justin Isherwood, and I want to remind you that his novels and books of essays can be picked up at your local bookstore. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Thanks again for riding with us today, and until next week, we're waving at you, and we're heading out of town.